Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. Now, you might remember the infamous case of Chinese scientist He Zhengkui, who in 2018 used CRISPR-Cas9 to edit the DNA of human embryos that were then implanted. He ultimately spent 3 years in prison for illegal medical practice, and his work was widely condemned across the globe. His approach was ill-advised for a number of different reasons, but a new process called base editing has eliminated a lot of the risk associated with embryo editing. So is this new, and is it something we want? Oliver Bauer is founding scientist at Preventive. He joins me now. So people who are familiar with the program may have heard of CRISPR-Cas9, but if they're new to the program or haven't heard of it, if you wouldn't mind just explaining what it is, please.
Sure thing. So CRISPR-Cas9 is effectively a pair of molecular scissors. So it uses two components, the CRISPR component and the Cas9 component. So CRISPRs are basically a form of genetic sequences that are used to program the enzyme Cas9. So the evolutionary history of this is that bacteria and viruses are constantly at battle with one another. And to do this, viruses inject their DNA into bacteria, and then they seek to hijack their machinery and make more copies of themselves. So the bacteria's defense mechanism is to try to take some of these viral sequences and then insert them into their own genome. That way, when they're attacked again, they can start producing all of these sequences. And then these sequences are a template used to latch onto other viral sequences. And then that works in complement with the Cas9 enzyme. So Cas9 enzyme, it is a biological catalyst, speeds up chemical reactions. So when given a given guide sequence, it will bind to that DNA and cut it apart. That's the general process it works. So it works kind of like a cut and paste mechanism, like a pair of molecular scissors.
Yeah, you've described that really well. But in terms of how we could use something like that to specify a particular part of a human genome, how do we program the bit that we want when it's a human genetic sequence that we're looking at?
So overall, the genetic sequence, you've got your four letters, your A, G, C, and T, and then the guide RNA itself, so this short section of material that you provide it, is usually about 20 base pairs in length. So in this way, this can be programmed almost without fail to any sequence that you can give it, whether that would be a human gene or a cow gene or a bacterial gene.
And this is so exciting. Jennifer Doudna, one of the researchers who was acknowledged with the Nobel Prize for this work, basically released this technology that allowed us to do amazing things, but it wasn't perfect. What is the difficulty with CRISPR-Cas9, and why can we not use it immediately now to fix so many genetic diseases and potential diseases in embryos today?
Yeah. So the real challenge with it is that while it is this highly programmable system, I mean, this is the pure beauty of it. You can give it really any 20 base pair sequence and it will find and identify that locus. The problem is, as I described, you know, this is a bacterial defense mechanism used to target and destroy viral DNA. In this way, it is very good at cutting DNA, but the cell's response to this, especially a human cell, its response to this, and for its purpose of doing precision genome editing, this is, you know, not how it's designed. It's designed to be a perfect cutter, but the what follows after that cutting and to seamlessly bring these strands together or introduce edits, this is much more down to error-prone cell machinery. So in this way, the editing system alone is very good for targeting DNA, but for making precision edits, this is the main challenge.
The cutting of the DNA, I get, but is the replacement DNA, does that come from just the environment? Because obviously DNA floating around in a cell, and if you have the A's will bind to G's and T's will bind to C's. Is it just like detritus floating in the cell? And once you've made the right cut, they naturally fit back in? Is that the idea?
Oh, yeah, no. So there's two major mechanisms here. So typically what will happen is when the cell fuses them together, this is a process called non-homologous end joining, which is a scary term, but basically it will just fuse the two strands back together. And often when it does this, there's quite a high chance it'll introduce errors because this is just a quick thing that cells do a lot of the time because there's always double strand breaks happening throughout the
right,
DNA.
Right, and in that case, you're literally removing the gene sequence rather than replacing it with something else.
Yeah, you won't remove the entire gene sequence, but it will get rid of a few bases in that sort of neighboring area. And then another one is called homology-directed repair. So often this is one where after it performs the cut, you can then introduce a template that you want to override in that cut. So you'll have your template on the left and right-hand sides. You'll have overlapping bases with the existing sequence and then a small inserting DNA that you want to modify there. But this is also, again, a very inefficient process. So all this together, the cutting's great, but what comes after of a cut, this is the problem.
And this is why you're looking on single base editing. So we mentioned GATC. These are the letters that make up the 3 billion pairs that you make up your DNA in your genome. To be able to identify a single letter and edit it in a clean way is the gold standard. It's what the holy grail of editing. Tell me about your recent paper.
Yes. So first of all, I'll introduce the base editing technology. So the base editing technology builds on conventional CRISPR-Cas9. So it still makes use of that Cas9 enzyme. So it still makes use of that programming and directing it to the DNA. But instead of cutting apart the strands completely, what this does is it takes the Cas9 enzyme and it fuses it to another enzyme. And this enzyme is called a base editing enzyme. What this does is when it's bound to that locus, when it's bound to that 20 base pair sequence, this base editing enzyme will then kick in and it will bind to specific letters and seamlessly convert them to act like another letter very simply. So in that way, you're avoiding this catastrophic cut and paste. And instead, it's a lot more like find and replace. Like if you're ever in Microsoft Word and you want to change all your commas into full stops or something like that. So that's on the technology side. Then on the actual biology of what we did, so we've just talked now a lot about the clinical and genome editing and how it could be used in treatment and patients, but the project really started as a basic biological project. We're very interested in my previous lab in early human embryology. We want to understand how the one cell begins to lay down the foundation for the rest of human development. And we study that in the first week of development. So in that time, over 7 days, embryo will become about 200 cells. And it will create three major populations. In general, this 200-cell structure, we call this a blastocyst. Now, if you want to imagine a blastocyst, this is kind of like, if you imagine a football. Now, this football is smaller than the head of a pin. It is only a few hundred micrometers in size. And then if you imagine this football, that then on the internal cavity of this football, you've got a small mass just there. So just like that, the outer structure of a football, that is what's going to implant into the mother, and that's what's going to go on to make the placenta. Then that inner population, there's two populations inside that. One of them is going to make what's called the yolk sac. This is going to be how the embryo gets its early nutrition before the placenta forms. And then the second one is called the epiblast. The epiblast is the very highly potential population that will give rise to the entire embryo. So we're interested in understanding over these 7 days, how you get 200 cells, how do you get this football structure, how do you get these three lineages, and how are they starting to lay down the foundation for their development? And we looked at a specific transcription factor, which is it's a type of protein. It binds onto DNA and unlocks and turns on and off other genes. So we were looking at a factor called NANOG. We wanted to use gene editing systems. We wanted to use the base editing system to target this gene NANOG, to turn it off. And then when it's turned off, to see the effect that's having on those early cell populations. So kind of like if you were in a company and you were an alien from another planet or something, and you wanted to understand why are light bulbs so important. And, you know, you could get rid of all the light bulbs in this company. And then you'd look around and everyone can't see very well. You can't see in the dark. And you can quickly assume from this, this is very important for people's correct function. So in the same way, if we take this base editing system and introduce these edits into this NANOG gene, then we can see the downstream effects it has on the formation of these three lineages.
How successful is this approach now in live? Did any of these blastocysts go on to be animals?
No. None of this went to live animals. So especially when you talked about Herjonqui at the start, none of this was done for reproductive or fertility processes. It was all done just to understand this first week of development, and then the embryos were terminated with. So yeah, this was the second major aspect of the paper, the technological aspect, building on this existing CRISPR-Cas9 technologies, which had already been used before in embryos to try and characterize and understand this thing. This is where we understand that a good portion of the time that this cutting and pasting mechanism just results in sections of the DNA being lost or damaged, destroyed, or just otherwise not how it's supposed to be. So the base editing system we found to be highly efficient. We found a tremendous high rate of editing in all of our samples. Most importantly, is we did see that there was none of this chromosomal material loss. We did not see particular damage and scarring at the on-target sites. This is suggesting a major step forward compared to conventional CRISPR-Cas9.
So, you know, in theory, on the face of it, this is a fantastic result. It means that we have a much more precise CRISPR-Cas9 that we can really go down to the individual level and not have the sort of errors you might associate with it. And yet at the same time, there has been sort of alarm, as there often is in this area, that this could be used in the wrong hands. And I'm wondering about, you know, when you publish a preprint or you publish your work and you know it's possible that someone might use your technique as you lay it out to do things that they're not supposed to do, how does that work? I mean, it is important to advance this because it could be hugely beneficial, but then you also can't control it once it's out there. I was wondering your thoughts on that.
I think it's I think that's one of the first aspects of it, is in terms of like, is this ready for, you know, going forward in this? I mean, this isn't what we set out to demonstrate. You know, this is basic biological study, and it's also tool development at the same time. And the results are reassuring and promising, but you know, the safety and assessment of this has been done at the level of a small team in an academic environment that was obsessed with a different question. We weren't obsessed about safety. We did a superficial pass, and we can make some claims about the chromosomal loss and things like this, but this doesn't rule out that there are still a long way to go with this technology. We still don't know the true extent of the off targets. We did not look at every single genomic location. Mm. And like I said, this 20 base pair guide RNA, this can also bind to other spots. You know, when you've got a 3 billion letter long code, there's a lot of areas where 20 base pairs overlap. So I wouldn't say, you know, this is ready for anything clinical or for a ready-to-term embryo. And I think that's for the purpose now for companies to try to identify and look into that. There is somewhat of a worry about publishing this sort of thing. But in the UK, for example, the work is highly regulated. We were frequently audited by the Human Fertilization Embryology Authority. All the embryos need to be processed and used before the 14-day rule. And we're prone to a lot of scrutiny throughout it. And I think for most jurisdictions in the world, there is a lot of scrutiny, especially after the Herjonqui affair. There is still continued worry that bad actors can go ahead with this. But that's why I think it's important to have these sort of conversations and say, this is not ready for clinical treatment yet. We are in a very early stage of it. This is a proof of principle, but I would definitely not advocate anyone to go forward with this.
Yeah, and I think that's a very reasonable answer. I also think that progress does also need to happen, because if we can prevent genetic diseases, you know, cystic fibrosis is a very big issue here in Ireland. We have Huntington's, of course. There are lots of diseases out there that if it was possible to remedy using precise genomic tools, we're ethically obliged to do that. So I think, you know, there's immense benefit to understanding how these tools work. And sometimes we want to be sure we don't let the negativity get too much in the way of advancing, you know, what can be really powerful technology. Oliver Bauer, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.